Good evening and welcome. It's KVCR. I'm David Fleming.
Hey, baby, won't you take a chance? Say that you'll let me have this dance. Well, listen. Well, listen. Well, do the twist and stomp the mashed potato too. Any old dance that you want to do. Well, listen. Well, listen.
The sole focus of tonight's program is on Ezequiel Christopher Montañez, better known to the world as Chris Montez. When Let's Dance hit the top 10 in 1962, he had the Beatles opening for him by the following year. But long before that, he was hanging out with some of the kids who would eventually be known as the Beach Boys. One of the first things I want to ask you about, and I suppose this is the legend and lore category, it comes from
okay,
a different interview.
Okay, let me hear what this lore has to say.
Well, it started with me misreading it, but I finally read it straight, and that is that you actually almost played with the Beach Boys, except we're talking about football in high school.
But Brian Wilson and I went out for a smaller team called the Bees, you know. And, you know, I wanted to be somebody. I wanted at least, you know, get some attention. I was a little guy, you know. Because I was always getting picked on in high school, you know, by the football players. And I always noticed that the guys who had letters always attracted the girls. Anyway, yeah, we went out, and I wasn't fast enough. I never was in condition. I was too little, and we had to run track. And Brian Wilson was going to be a quarterback that was throwing. But I find out later Brian didn't want to get into it. He was scared. He didn't like get rucked.
Oh!
And I just didn't qualify. That was the bottom line, you know.
He was scared and you didn't qualify. Okay.
Yeah.
He didn't want to
get into the, you know, it was too much of a hassle for him, he said. You know.
Gotcha. Did you guys both then end up playing music together? I mean, different bands, of course, eventually.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I had him in a couple of my classes and we'd always talk, you know, and also Carl Wilson was also going to school there.
Yep.
And Dennis later. But they were like a couple of years behind us and I used to go to their house. You know, Brian would be on an organ, and Dennis and Carl would be playing, and myself. And we said, I go over there and jam with them. I said, you know, we're in high school. We never thought about recording. Well, I didn't anyway. Hmm. I just wanted to try to get good on playing guitar. And we play together, play songs, and, you know, we do some rock. And let's do, like, Johnny B. Goode. Okay, man, you know, I do this. And that was our routine, really. It was, you know, just hanging out. And one time, Dennis says to me, hey, Chris, you like malts? And I always like malts, you know,
yeah.
Ice cream malts.
Oh, yeah.
I said, yeah. He says, you want me to make you one? I said, you're kidding me. Because, you know, I come from a different environment, and we didn't have machines to, like, you know, make malts. All that I had at my home growing up, other than a little shack, was coffee and beans and tortillas. That was it. We didn't have all those facilities like that. So he puts in a couple of scoops of ice cream, and this was during a break, and he makes this malt, and he says, here's the secret, because I was wondering what it was, and he pulls out this jar, and it was malt, you know, the powder.
Yeah, yeah.
And he puts it in there and makes it, and it was wonderful. I said, wow, Dennis, that's the best malt I ever had.
Nice. Wow.
And I remember that so clearly because, yeah, he was a good kid, you know, good guy. We were all good people, you know. Brian was a real nice person, funny guy. Carl was a quietist. Dennis, he was the one that always messed around. One time we had a science class, and there was a teacher he was like 6'2", maybe, bald. And then during the summer, during the class, when it was warm, he'd always, okay, students, settle down. And so he'd always take his handkerchief and blow his nose, you know, and then he'd wipe his forehead sometimes, you know. And so one time he was called out, so he points at Brian, and he says, Brian, take over the class and just watch it for a minute. So so he leaves, and Brian gets up, okay, kids, okay, settle down. You know, we're about sophomores or juniors. And he imitated him to a T. He takes out like a handkerchief and blows his nose, pretend, and wipes his head. No, I want you guys to, you know, start telling. And at that time, after he just done that, the teacher walked in, and we all straightened out because we were all laughing, you know.
Yeah.
It was a funny scene, like, you know, Grease kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You pretty much grew up with music long before high school, but once you got to high school, you were not so much with the music, weren't you? This is now straight from your website. You were really trying to go for more of a tough guy, lowrider image. Is this correct?
No, you know, it's funny. I got harassed even from the principals. When I go to see the principals or the ones who are supposed to guide your life, you know, the last meeting I had with the principal says, we don't like the way you're dressing. You know, you got to change your dress. And all I wore was khaki pants and combed my hair back. And, you know, and I was always clean cut. You know, clean.
Pretty
you know?
Normal.
I was particular how I looked.
Yeah.
And that wasn't in their realm. You know, they thought I was rowdy because at that time, Mexicans were sort of frowned upon. They were troublemakers, you know, into drugs and all that. That wasn't what I was. I was just a happy-going but cool guy. I was like the person who wears a leather jacket. That's
gotcha.
Who I was, like a Fonzie. But one time they said, and I was a good student. I had good marks because I always applied myself. And that, after that, I just said, you know what? I don't even care about going to school because I never thought about it, college. And they never once mentioned college to me. I didn't think I would qualify. I thought I had to be an A student. So make a long story short, I said, you know what? Forget it. I'm going to play this game. I said, dear Lord, I'm going to change this whole thing. I'm going to beat them at their game. So what I did after summer break in the sophomore year when I was going into my junior year, I went completely Ivy League. I cut my hair short. I parted it. I wore button-down pants and the collars, and all of a sudden I'm hanging with now I'm hanging with the rowdies, and I'm hanging with the, you know, the socias. That's what they were called, socias.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes,
socias. You know, the lettermen, you know, the guys, you know, so I'd be going and hanging out with some of them, you know. But they didn't know that I was the same person, but I'd always hang out with the homeboys, and then I'd come back. So I was living two lives. And I remember this friend of mine who became my best friend. He died after high school. Mm. And he was a football player. He was a tough guy, and he was a Cherokee Indian. His name was Bill Boyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always have to calm him down because we'd always get in trouble, and sometimes I'd be in too much trouble. And so his friends used to tell him, the socias would say, because he always wore the white bucks and the white shoes and all that.
Sure.
We were tight. We were brothers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They always say, hey, why do you hang around with that guy and his friends? He said, hey, he's my friend. And my friends would say, why do you hang around with that socia, you know? And I said, that's like my brother. You know what I mean? It's funny.
You were getting it from both ends.
Yes. So finally he left the school, and then he became a real rowdy guy. He became the opposite that I became.
Mm.
But we were like brothers. We'd always play together. In fact, on this first demo that I ever made, he was playing guitar in it with me, him and the drummer. She's My Rockin' Baby was one song I wrote, and Forgive Me. And it was a ballad, and the other one was sort of fast, kind of, not real fast anyway, but medium tempo.
Okay.
And I thought that was the first thing I ever did, so I thought it was pretty cool, but I never thought about making a recording. I wrote these songs, and I think, hey, man, you know, listen to this. And I got my friends, and we drove all the way to Long Beach, California, which is from Hawthorne, where I grew up, was about an hour, and I had to have somebody take me there, you know. So I remember the guy saying, okay, you ready? And I'm not scared, but it took me a long time to gather $25, and this is for a half hour. So I said, okay, come on, guys. And we got all set up, and I started singing my first song, and I said, can I do it over again? He said, sure. It was good enough for me, and then the other one was a ballad, you know. Forgive Me, My Darling. It was like a Richie Valens thing, I guess, you know,
okay.
Before I even got into that whole scene. To make a long story short, that was the beginning of my life and career, because out of the blue, somebody calls my home, and my mother never spoke English. My father also didn't speak English. And I used to come home, I walk from high school, never had a car, and I watch a Dick Clark show when I get a chance.
Of course.
That was like the number one show, and I watch all these rock and roll artists, which it's funny. I've run across all of them, and they know who I am. So it's kind of a delayed reaction or whatever you want to call it. So I come home, and my mother says, you know, there's somebody trying to call you, and he wants to talk to you about recording. I said, who? I mean, what? I thought maybe she misunderstood. And I'll be darned, I talked to these people, and it was Barry Dvorak and Billy Sherman. But Barry Dvorak was a producer, so he helped me write the first song, which was All You Had to Do Was Tell Me, because I started writing it. So he sort of gave me a format of how to write two lyrics, bridge, a lyric, you know what I mean?
Gotcha.
Two verses, lyric. That was the beginning of it, because I remember sitting and we're writing All You Had to Do Was Tell Me. You know, he already knew the song, but he's helping me write the lyrics. And all of a sudden, there's a knock on the door, and somebody comes in and says, oh, come on in. I turn around, and he said, oh, this is Johnny Burnett. I said, you're Johnny Burnett? He said, yeah, how you doing, Chris? He's a real Southern friendly guy, you know. I said, wow. He says, and so he talks a few minutes. Oh, it's nice to meet you, Chris. And he took off, and he had the number one song. It was You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine.
Yeah, You're Mine. Yeah, wow.
It was amazing to me, you know.
And David Fleming in conversation with Chris Montez. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. More on Montez at chrismontez.com.
All you had to do became certain hits in different states, you know, but it wasn't a real heavy hit. But prior to that, I went to this little hop in Hawthorne, and Richie Valens was coming in.
Oh, cool.
And he was my hero.
Yeah.
I think it cost me a couple bucks with a struggle. Then I went to this hop, and it was all sold out, and the band was playing there. Took a break, and they said, Richie will be out in a minute, so I'm standing way at the back of this hop. I wanted to hear Richie sing La Bamba and Donna, and that was the end of it.
Sure.
I could say that I heard him sing these songs, and I was there, you know. And so I'm standing. It'll be in 15 minutes, and I'm standing way in the back of the hop, and all of a sudden, to my right, Richie Valens is standing next to me, of all places. And I glanced to the right and said, wow, you're Richie Valens. He's standing next to me, like I thought it was somebody watching the show.
Yeah, right.
I stumbled for words, and he shook my hand. I said, I was just so thrilled. I didn't know what else to say. I said, I want to be a singer. And he smiled, oh, good. And that was it. And about 5 months or 6 months later, he died in a plane crash with the rest of the guys, Buddy Holly and a Big Bopper.
Yeah, Big Bopper.
And
yeah.
I remember saying to myself, if I ever become popular, which I was never thinking of that, or any kind of accent, I said, if I ever become famous or something like that, I said, I'm going to treat people like Richie Valens treated me. And that's been my motto, you know, because I run across a lot of artists and people say, he's unfriendly or this, and I just, I don't make comments, you know. That's not me, you know.
It was just a few years later, after you got out of high school then.
I'm trying
to do the math here. You probably graduated in what, 59, 60, right in there?
No, I graduated in 61.
Okay, 61.
Oh, yeah, 61, yes.
Well, gosh, then Let's Dance, didn't that come out just the next year?
Something like that. Wait a minute. Okay, I'll take it back to later part of 60. I was doing these recordings, and they weren't happening. And then a new producer, he said, I could sell that person. I guess that's what it is. His name was Jim Lee.
Jim
who
Lee,
wrote Let's
yes.
Dance. I remember, next thing I know, that it was a hit. You know, and it's funny, I didn't want to record that song because I didn't think that was my style. Mine was the ballads and singing to the ladies and being cool, you know.
So
but,
did
I mean,
you...
I was a rocker. I played guitar, some guitar, you know.
Yeah, you sure did.
So then the next thing I knew, I did the Dick Clark Show, which was amazing to me. I never been out of L.A. I never been on an airplane. I was by myself on a plane with a suitcase and my music.
Oh, my
gosh.
My
guitar.
Suddenly you were on the caravan.
Yeah. Well, I did the Dick Clark Show, and then I did part of his caravan. And the next thing they said, you have to go do the theaters. I'm saying, wow. And it was the Howard, the Apollo, those three theaters that they always play at. And I remember getting off the subway. I said, where's 78th Street? I'm just throwing a number, right? So we're going, all of a sudden, the doors open. They pushed me out, like, you know, and there I am with my guitar and my music and my suitcase. And I'm, where do I go, you know?
Oh, gosh.
And it was like, all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of the ghetto, right? The heavyweight, because I'm doing the Apollo. That's the theaters that I'm...
Right, yeah,
and all
Harlem.
Of a sudden, there's this big, tall guy, I would say about 6'4", something, big individual. And he says, young man, I said, yeah. He says, where are you going? I said, I got an Apollo. He says, you want me to help? I said, yeah. He says, I'll carry this stuff for you, and I'll do it for a couple of dollars. And I said, sure, you know, I wasn't thinking. And here I'm going through the baddest part of the city, and everybody's watching us. It was like a guardian angel sent to me. It always happens. I always have somebody waiting for me. And I would say it was an angel sent from the Lord. I really say that. I stand on that. Because nobody else would come and stand there and approach me and say, can I help you and take me, you know. People don't have time for that, especially at that time. Bad part of town, main part of the city, and everybody's watching us, you know. And then when I got to the theater, it was raining, and so I paid him. And I said, thank you very much. And he walked off, and that was it. It was gone, like the wind. Like, wow, strange.
I wonder if he's right now saying, man, he's telling the story of how he carried equipment for Chris Montez.
Yeah. I don't think he really realized who it was. He was a little older than me, but he was a kind gentleman, you know.
Nice.
And nobody would mess with him because he was tall and bad, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of those tours. And then from, because those theaters, we were doing like 6 shows a day.
Oh, my gosh.
And I go out there the first show after the rehearsal with the guys. I put the music and they say, hey, Chris, how does the song go in letter A and the repeat signs and all this? They're giving me all this language about repeat signs on music bars. I had no idea what the hell are we talking about.
Wow.
I said, what do you guys? They said, oh, sing us a song. So I did. So we finally got through that whole show like that. Next thing I'm doing, I'm on the show with Smokey Robinson, Jerry Butler, all these black artists on the show. And we go out there, the same routine. And the Orlans were another one, you know. Oh, dog back, you know, this
yeah.
kind of. And I go out there in the first show, and it was like almost noon, 12:30. And I do my whole routine, and I come back and I hear 1 or 2 claps. That's all there was out there.
What?
Maybe
oh.
2 people, 3, yeah. It was a movie theater. And that went on for 5 shows with all these guys, and it's getting fuller, you know, and then there'd be 40 people and 60, and by the last show, it would be full. So that's how they broke me in.
Wow.
Isn't well, that something?
You were outnumbering the audience for the first 3 quarters
yeah,
of your
yeah.
each day. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It was
wow.
5, 6 people. I mean,
oh.
you know, the Apollo Theater and those kind of theaters are big theaters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're movie theaters, really.
Yeah.
So I just took it for granted. And I was saying, well, okay.
Well, you had mentioned that in East L.A. in the 50s, it was folks yeah. like Clyde McFadder and the Drifters, I guess, with and without McFadder, I suppose, Big J. McNeely. These were the folks of the radio, and this is who you gravitated toward. So now here you were on the road with McFadder
yeah.
and Sam Cooke, and
yeah,
so you mentioned Smokey.
Yeah. I mean, what's happening was the rhythm and blues ideas, you know, because my family, my brothers and sisters were always dancing to rhythm and blues, and they had instrumental honky-tonk and all that. But I never thought about getting into music then until I heard Ritchie Valens, and I bought his album, and I learned every song and tried to emulate his style and his voice. It's funny. It was meant to be, I guess.
You know, as I was growing up, I was listening to artists like Little Richard, Chuck Berry, the Everly Brothers, and of course the Platters. And then Elvis Presley became the king of rock and roll. Thank you very much. But in my neighborhood, Ritchie Valens was the king of rock and roll.
Ritchie was certainly an influence, but I wanted to ask you about this very pointedly,
yeah.
I suppose. It had to have been more than his music, yes? I mean, he was also an influence in that he was a person from the Chicano community
yeah,
who had actually
Mexican,
made it.
Yeah, that's what motivated it. Wow. Because Valens, well, Valenzuela.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like my last
yeah.
name is Montañez, but they cut it to Montes or
yeah.
Montez, people say it. And I said, wow, he's a Mexican rocker. Maybe I have a chance because I was into music then, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe I can do something. And that's what formulated my whole life was that incident, knowing he existed and he was Mexican American. It's funny, his brothers and sisters are good friends of mine. They brought me into their family. Beyond just meeting Ritchie, it's like his sisters will call me and all that. And, you know, like I'm part of their life. And I just did Clear Lake, Iowa, because they have a hop. That was where they took off from.
Oh, right, yes.
And that was when I first met the sisters. And you know, we're doing the show, and I'm doing like Donna and La Bamba.
Yeah.
And after the show, they gave me a big gold album, you know, the size of an album.
Oh, wow.
It's 33 and a half. It's presented to me from the family. On the gold record, it has Ritchie Valens' little face on the top, and then Buddy Holly on the right, and the Big Bopper on the left, like stamped in there.
Oh, my gosh.
It's beautiful. Yeah, those kind of things, I feel so honored. I don't know what. How can I express myself? I just feel so just honored. I'm just lucky, you know?
Most certainly. Yes, yes.
Oh,
listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Back now to Chris Montez, and now stories of his time in 1963 with a relatively new band called The Beatles. We'll hear about his influence on their wardrobe, not quite being able to keep up with them in the party scene, and having a beer dumped on his head by John Lennon. Let's jump over to a period. I'd like to hear about you going over to England.
Okay, let's go through that era. Before I went to England, I was, you know, circulating all these clubs, and all of a sudden I get a call, and my manager says, they want you to do a tour, and it's with Sam Cooke. I said, oh, okay, good, you know. And he was one of my favorite artists at the time, you know, when he had Bring It On Home to Me, which was a big hit.
Yeah.
And I did this tour with him. Boy, talking about rough. I mean, every night they'd be partying and get on, not Sam, but the entourage and the musicians. And that's when I got my first taste of being on this tour. And, man, you know, they never sleep. They get in and start drinking whiskey, and we'd be going on these few-hour trips on these buses with the seats were hard as, well, they were made out of wood.
Yeah.
And I try to sleep, and they'd be, Chris, come on. You know, and they'd be have some of the girls, and I was just trying to get, I mean, I just wasn't into that scene then, you know. I was just trying to do my gig because I was told this is what you do in your tour, you know, just do your job. But I got exposed to a lot of stuff, and I remember that's when I first saw Black and White Only, and I was amazed. I couldn't believe it in this country, Black and White. I mean, I left L.A., and it's like I'm in a foreign country, like,
you know,
a terrible part of the country. They look at me, if I walk into the restaurants in the white, I'd feel uncomfortable because they thought maybe I was part black. And I go into the black area, and they thought I was too white. And so I was confused. And I remember saying to someone, I wish they had a in-between restaurants. You say in-between, you know, whatever you are. But I remember a lot of times in the night, we'd be going, traveling, and we see these food places where it was like a gas station with food, but it was no gas. It was, you know, where you get hamburgers and all that.
Sure.
In the middle of nowhere. So I'd have to get out and get food for them. They could go behind the building and get served with a window over there, or they could expedite it if I would go through the front. And I was with the Drifters and a few other guys, and I remember saying, hey, Chris, get us 8 hamburgers and cheeseburgers. So I'm there and ordering this, and this guy's cooking, you know, like you see in movies, you know, flipping the hot hamburgers and with his hat on. And all of a sudden, a couple of the guys come to the counter. Hey, get away from the counter! He yelled at him. Wow, it was a shock to me. He says to me, are they with you? And I said, yeah. And he flipped these hamburgers, didn't even put no heart in it. He says, here, get out of here. Give them to me. That was, you know, one of the things I went through. And I did that a few times.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Oh, anyway, so I used to watch Sam Cooke sing to the ladies because my manager told me, see what they do, how they act on stage and what they say on stage. And, you know, so that's, I had a lot of learning process on that.
Of course.
So when I came back, I did a couple of shows here at the Cinnamon Cinder or somewhere in Hollywood here. And I get out, and I'm Mr. Cool, right?
Mm.
I just got off this big tour, and I'm somebody, you know, I'm known. So I start singing to the girls, and I guess I get a little risque. I didn't realize, you know, just moving a little bit here and there was being risque. I was just singing to the girls, trying to charm them. And when I got off, the manager said to me, you know, you did great. He says, but you got to bring it down. I said, I thought you wanted me to learn what was happening. He said, no, that's too much, a little too much. And it wasn't bad, but it was too much, you know. And so I did a couple major tours with him. That was the second one.
That's Chris Montez, part of the lineup with Legends of Doo-Wop, Soul, and Rock and Roll. The show also features Terry Johnson's Flamingos, Mel Carter, and Carla Cook. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org.
So I come back, and then all of a sudden they say, you know, they want you to go to England. And I said, England? Wow. Okay. So next thing I'm on a plane, and when we flew in, it's funny. It's a whole new world. I mean, you know, all the streets were cobblestone. They spoke funny, you know, and they were all glad to meet me and all this. And so I went, and then said, okay, tomorrow you got rehearsal with the guys, with the band. And this is the other group. They're playing with you, the first of the bill, the warm-up band. So all of a sudden I meet the guys, and they say, oh, yeah, these are they're called the Beatles. Hey, guys, how you doing? You know, and they were glad to meet me, you know. And I remember I bought these clothes in Hollywood. I can't remember the name, but I still have the jackets. And this gentleman who used to dress me, he said, I got just the right coats for you. And so we'll get back to the Beatles thing. So he sells me these coats and dress pants, and this was my stage attire. And he says to me, you'll be in because, you know, this is what's happening in Europe. So when I get over there and I wear this jacket, and everybody's saying, wow, where'd you get that jacket? I like to have that jacket or something. And I'm saying, wow, that guy lied to me. I thought this was the end thing. You know? I thought I was the end thing with a British look, but I was far from it. You know?
Oh, no.
Yeah. So all these people wanted, so this is what I wore on stage, the colorless jacket, and I do this, and I sing to the girls, and I get on my knees and sing this ballad called You're the One. It's on the Let's Dance album. So my first adventure was being ripped up by the girls, and in that whole scene that you see of people running to the buses and running to the streets and standing out the windows. I remember being in a hotel and looking up, and I was with Paul and George, and we're hanging out in this room, and Paul would say, hey, to Ringo, he said, go up by the window because there's a bunch of crowd. We're like four floors up. And he'd go out there, and they start yelling, and we'd laugh, you know. You go up there, because I go there, you know, all this stuff. And it was funny to me, and it was funny to them, you know. And I remember doing our first show, and I heard him play, and I said, wow, because I was prepared, I thought, you know. Because I've been already doing a lot of touring and learning from heavyweights.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I was pretty well prepared. And then all of a sudden when I hear the first night, and here's the Beatles, and they go, hey, clack, 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 you know, they sort of cheer. And Paul starts doing Long Tall Sally. I'm going to tell Long John about, you know, so-and-so. And I said, wow, they're rocking. I said, man, these guys are rockers. But never made a correlation that they had been playing in all the roughest bars. So they were sort of honed to what they knew what it was about, you know what I mean?
Wow.
I used to watch them do Love Me Do. That was the first singing coming in. Love, Love Me Do, Paul, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of everything because we joke and we get rushed by the girls, and I had so many girlfriends I couldn't even count them, and that was a realm, you know.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, I was shell-shocked. But it was like I remember when I was growing up, I was rough enough just getting a girlfriend to hang out with me or girlfriends or pay attention. All of a sudden, I got hundreds of girlfriends, thousands. You know, it's unbelievable. So as Tommy Rowe was on a tour, and myself and the Beatles would open, and we hung out a lot together, and we had a few beers, and they'd tell me about England, and tell me about these, and I go walk with them. One time, they said, come on, Chris. So I went with George and Paul. They took me to their tailor, and I had some boots made, and I had some jackets made, beautiful hand-stitched suits. I wish I had them.
Oh, yeah.
I never thought anything of it. So I remember we got to be good friends, and one time they disappeared for a few days. We had 2 days off, and they come back and said, where were you guys? They said, oh, we were finishing our album. I said, oh, and Paul says, come on. We had a special room up there, and we were sitting around, and so Paul puts this album on, and the first song I heard was, well, she was just 17. I said,
oh my God.
I couldn't believe this. I said, wow. And I heard the rest of the album, but I had Paul play that song. Play it again, will you, Paul? And he put it in. You like that song? I said, yeah. He played it for me about 5 times, you know. And that was the first time that album was ever heard. You know, it was a wonderful thing. And then we hung out a lot. And one time I was at a party, and it was getting toward the end of the tour. And, you know, I was burned out, you know, because every night there'd be social situations, and then people have parties for us. And one time was this real big house and having fun, and I just said, I'm tired. And I went back to the bus and sat out, and I was just tired. You know, after a while, everything gets redundant. You get burned out behind it, you know. So I'm sitting there on the bus, and I hear all these guys rah, rah, laughing and getting. You know, asleep. I knew it was a guy, you know, and they're talking. And all of a sudden, John Lennon pours a beer on my head. You know, pours beer. I got up and I said, you son of a... And I rushed him, and we got into a little row. And that was a story with John Lennon and I. We finally made up. You know, the Beatles were always great. Paul was a wonderful person. He was always wonderful. George was wonderful, and Ringo was a kind of funny guy, but John was a good person. He was a good dude, you know what I mean? You know, I was honored to be on tour with him. From that way back from making him first recording to hanging out with, turned out to be the greatest rock and roll band in the world, you know?
Oh, my gosh, certainly.
That's amazing to me, meeting my idol and then going over there and being with these guys. And then all of a sudden, I remember when we were finishing signing our goodbyes, and I had him sign my program. And Paul and John were talking to their tailor, right? Right there where I'm reading. He said, hey, we're talking to our tailor. And Paul says, yeah, we're going to get some new suits. But he says, we're going to design them like your jacket. I hope you don't mind. I said, no, I never thought anything of it. I thought it was quite a great compliment. Dress like your dress, you know, get a coat like yours.
Yeah.
And I still have those coats. That first album, Meet the Beatles. You see him with that round collar?
Yeah, the little Nuru jacket kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was wearing, Nuru jacket, yeah.
So you are the reason for them being in those jackets?
That was the, yeah.
I didn't expect that. That's a funny thing
about him saying, you know, because I wouldn't have assumed anything. You know, you design whatever you want, or, yeah, we sort of copy. But when Paul said, we're having our jackets made like your style, you know, that jacket. I said, oh, that's cool. And that was the end of it, you know.
Oh, wow.
Never thought anything of that, you know. And that, to me, it's just how everything works out, you know. You never know where you're going in life and what's happening in your life. And that was a historic thing, people think. You know how people talk. It's just an experience for me.
Certainly.
It hasn't changed me a bit. I was just glad I've been around doing this stuff.
But now people are going to be bringing you Beatles albums to get signed.
Yeah, so. Yeah. In fact, I just sold the program a couple weeks ago to this agent, these people that bid for them.
Right.
Yeah, it was a big one. And
wow.
So what I did is I copied the one page that they signed where everybody's on the back of the program. Paul says, Long Live the King and so a Queen and this and that. And Paul says, yeah, it was great working with something like that. And John Lennon writes, Chris, remember Mansfield? And that was his comment. And that's where we got into it, in Mansfield. And that's what he says, you know. And John Lennon, you know. So I had that copied. I had it scanned, and I think I'm going to take them out on the road and sell them to people so they can have a souvenir. It's a wonderful souvenir.
Yeah, you got that right. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And now
yeah.
I bet you the person that has the original of that, that paid for it in the auction, they probably don't even know the significance of Remember Mansfield.
No. Well, yeah, I wrote a letter to
authenticity.
You know. But it's a piece of history that goes on forever, you know. People come up to you, yeah, you're Chris Montez, you know, you tour with the Beatles, wow, you're a legend and all that.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh because when you go back to where I was in high school, you know, and scrounging for some money, never had a car, and all of a sudden, I'm a legend, you know. It makes me laugh.
Oh, my gosh. And you know what? I have to say, you weren't touring with the Beatles. The Beatles were touring with you at this point.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
They were the opening act.
Yeah.
So it says Chris Montez, Tommy Rowe on the program, and then also the Beatles, a little clip on the bottom. Can you believe
interesting.
That?
Listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. We are streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming, back now to Chris Montez, the sole focus of tonight's program. Just ahead is Move to A&M, Herb Alpert's new label, and still being able to hang out with the Beatles after the tour was over.
So when I came back from that tour, this is a good story, I always remember, because I used to like to surf a lot, so I'm laying by the beach, and I just got out of the water. I'm kicking back, and I got my little radio. I'm listening. I hear the radio music being played in a rock and roll. I don't know which station it was. And then all of a sudden, and the Beatles have just landed. And you hear all this roar, you know. And yeah, the Beatles have just landed. This big event.
Oh, my
gosh. I'm laying back on the sand. I'm saying, big deal. I just did the tour with them, you know. And that's how I thought, simple, big deal, you know. And it made me laugh because in one instance, you're on the road, next minute, you know, they're in America, it's coming over, and it's an overwhelming thrill to have them, you know. When I just, it's like, I just hung out with them a few days ago, you know, that kind of concept. So, you know, I'm saying, oh, it's great, they're here, you know. And so I get a call, and they said, they want me to come over and see them. The Beatles want to see you, and they want to see you. I said, all right. So, you know, in Bel Air, there's a lot of police and a lot of crowds, and they, you know, how fans are. So I got in there, and I walk into this home, you know, and walk, and it's not a long hallway, just a big hall, you know, this big house. And I saw Paul McCartney sees me, and he comes and gets on his knees, and he starts singing, you're the one, you know, the song that I used to sing to the girl, sometimes I take my shirt off. So he was emulating me, you know, kidding me.
beautiful.
I mean, it's funny, you know. And I thought, come on, Paul, he's on his knees singing. I mean, it's embarrassing to me. You know, he was clowning with me.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, come on, Paul. How you doing, Chris? You know, it was weird.
Wow.
And I'll never forget that because it was a wonderful incident that I didn't think anything of it. But now when I think about where he was and that he always liked to clown around, joke around, you know.
Another period that I would love to discuss with you, I'd like to hear about your opportunity to record with Herb Alpert, going over to A&M Records.
Herb Alpert, okay.
Yeah, how did that happen for you?
So after this tour and all these records, I had a fallout with the manager who robbed me, and, you know, it wasn't great money because we weren't making that great, but it wasn't big money to me, you know?
Yeah.
So I finally signed off with him and had to walk away from him. I had a lawyer take care of it for me. By chance, these lawyers came into my life, just dropped, you know, just by connection. Anyway, so I go to A&M. Well, I go with this horn player that I used to hang out with him, play at bars with him a long time ago. And he said, come on, Chris, I'm going to go pick up my tapes at this recording studio and this company. And I said, no, I don't want to go. He said, come on, keep me company. So I went. And so this person, I didn't know who it was, Herb Alpert, come out and said, hey, Bob, I can't use your songs. Thanks anyway. And Bob said, okay, that's all right. And he says, oh, by the way, this is Chris Montez. And Herb Alpert says, but I didn't know him as Herb Alpert. He said, you're Chris Montez, a singer? I said, yeah. He says, what are you doing right now? I said, I'm going to college. I'm studying music. He said, wow, I'd like to record you. I'd like to record you for my company. Would you be interested? I said, no, not really. I don't want to do that anymore. He said, well, think about it. You know? So a few months later, I went, and I said, okay, I'll do this. So I go with his staff producer, and I was playing harmonica, and I wrote some good rock tunes. And I'm doing this, you know. And all of a sudden, the staff producer says to me a few days later, says, Herb doesn't like what we've done. He doesn't like any of it. I said to myself, this is why I didn't want to get into recording, because here I've got to go this whole routine again. They're going to can me again or give me this baloney. So he says, Herb's got a song. He wants you to, he's got an idea for you. He wants you to go in his office. So I said, okay, I go in there. I sit down, and Herb says, hey, how's it going? Herb's a very hip dude. I mean, he's a hip dude. Drizzle's hip, he's hip, and he's into music. And so he says, hey, Chris, how's it going? All right. He didn't say anything of recording. He says, yeah, I got an idea for you. I said, okay. So I'm waiting, and he starts snapping his fingers. And he says, it goes like this. If you're feeling sad and lonely,
that's the
there's
one.
A service. I said to myself, you got to be kidding me. Hey, I'm a Richie rock and roller, you know. You give me this, that song is like for the hip boys, the Sinatras and that kind of stuff. That was that category, I thought it was.
Yeah.
So I said, all right. He said, so he rehearsed it with me at the studio, and he says, and so when I'm recording this song, he's standing next to me. Okay, guys, we're from the basics. First we come in, and the guys and musicians are all there, and he knows them all. He said, hey, guys, and so he runs the songs to them, and he makes little changes on the drummer. Can you give me sort of a ta-ta-ta? And the piano player, can you give me something? Yeah, we got it, Herb. So we run it through, and he said, okay, let's take it. So I rehearsed it one time, and he's standing next to me, and the next set, he's standing next to me and guiding me while I'm recording. If you're feeling sad, he's like next to me, and he's like got the groove going for me, you know. And I was just trying to do my best just to please him. I knew I could do it, you know? And the next thing I know, it became a hit, you know, from left field, you know. And then Herb Alpert's company really started taking off from that, and his album started taking off. So we sort of got it rolling at the same time.
Oh, that's cool.
And that was a wonderful experience, you know.
Yeah, I did some of the math in this. So when Call Me was released, wasn't both yours and Petula Clark's released at close to the same time?
You know what? I didn't know that Petula Clark had recorded it. Somebody said, yeah, she recorded one of her albums, but I never even heard the song.
Yeah, it was a short album, EP or something.
So, you know, and then, and funny, just to make a long story, I did a show with her last year on a boat cruise. And see, I didn't know that she was such a wonderful, not only an artist, but she was well-trained in theater and playing
piano. God, yes. Yes.
I didn't know that.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Chris Montez. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. More on Montez at chrismontez.com.
Next thing I know, they want me to do The More I See You. I never heard that song.
Right.
So now I'm into this hip kind of thing. I've got my hair cut real short. It's parted. I'm wearing, you know, suits, ties, and, you know, I thought that was a cool thing, you know. I can't tell you the things I went through all that shit. And, you know, I was watching television one time, and I see this movie, and I see this guy, big band, you know, in the 40s, and all of a sudden I hear, The More I See You. And he was the idol. And it was Dick Haynes. Dick Haynes, yeah.
Wow.
And I said, you got to be kidding me. So, you know, all these songs I wasn't familiar with.
Wow.
But they happened.
Yeah,
it was meant to be.
Yeah, and A&M, you had a lot of stuff, and it was different than the rock and roll approach that you had been doing.
Yeah, because Herb Albert got me into this niche, and all of a sudden, Tommy LaPuma started bringing all these standards, and Nick DiCaro was the arranger, musical. He was a great person. I'll never forget him. He was wonderful. DiCaro was the best arranger, and he had a great voice, and he'd cover me, you know, so he'd help me get through these songs, you know. From now, I'm singing, Fly Me to the Moon.
Right.
Let me play. I'm thinking, I'm singing those kind of songs when I'm on to doing the ballads with the Beatles, you know. How did that happen, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. It's such a different kind of thing. And so the reason I even ask about this is that in the middle of all this, you did Little Red Riding Hood, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs.
Yeah, right. And Sam LaSham and I are good friends.
Oh, are you? Okay.
I call him all the time.
Okay, still. Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, I have to be honest. At this point, I have yet to hear your version. And I love his version just because I love novelty songs. When you sang it,
it was okay. You know, when you reflect on things, at the time you think you're in a pocket or you're going through the pocket. But now that I have more experience in my life and... By the way, when I was going through this whole process, even when I first got married in my 20s, I think I was 22, I had got married, and the next thing I know, I have a little girl. And then next time, I have twin boys. So all of a sudden, I got three kids.
Oh, my gosh.
You know? And at that time, they said, you know, keep it hush. Don't tell anybody you're married because it'll ruin your career and all that, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it make a long story short. So meanwhile, when I was married, I just came back, I think it was from England or sometime after that, way later. And I picked up this paper at the office because I was doing some paperwork with my managers toward A&M time, you know. And I saw this guy advertising theory and music and all that. So I called him. I started going to him in Beverly Hills. And he said to me, you know what? It's better if you come to the class. I'm teaching at the Conservatory of Music in Sunland. He said, you know, it'd be cheaper and you'd have more students in there. So I did. And he wrote the whole curriculum, you know. I have all his four volumes. Traditional harmony, you know, two-part harmony, you know, composition. So I got through that. But meanwhile, I'm going a couple of days a week or three times a week at night and writing at night, trying to write these lessons. And it wasn't easy. I spent hours just to write. And he'd write that lesson in 3 minutes.
Oh, my gosh.
Because of the rules. And I had to get used to the rules. So that was the beginning of that. And then from that time, then I went, during A&M, I went and studied at Dick Grove School of Jazz, which was the number one jazz. You know, he opened up, and I got to hang out with the man himself, Dick Grove, you know.
Wow.
So he's the one that introduced me to the whole foundation and secret of playing jazz, and that was amazing to me.
Wow.
So meanwhile, all this whole deal, when I'm doing this, I had left A&M because I was getting lost in the shuffle, and I thought, I can get a gig somewhere. I can get another recording. I listened to some people, which was a mistake, and it didn't happen. I think I left a bad mark with A&M, but I was nice leaving. I just said, I'm getting lost. So Herb Alpert, I guess, understood. And they offered me some good money to stay, which I should have, but I didn't. You know, who knows? So I hear they're opening a Latino record company. So me, with my tail between my legs, are sort of, you know, walking in. And Jose Quintana was the head A&R guy, you know. So I bring him all these tunes that I had written because of what I studied with the standards, you know, with the jazz company. I end up doing a contract, and Herb Alpert said, yeah, sign him back. We'll do this Latin album. And everything I learned was because I learned from that jazz school. So I remember going back after finishing the album, and I put this album in front of Dick Grove, and he says, what's that? I said, here's my new album. I said, it's because of what you taught me, that all these songs I wrote because of what you taught me.
Oh, my gosh.
He goes, wow, okay. You know? So that whole thing happened. Then Billy Michelle from CBS International came looking for me. And we recorded a few things, and all of a sudden I recorded a bilingual song I wrote called I No Digas. It's a Mexican polka, but it's mostly just a phrase in Spanish and the rest. And it became very popular in Europe and everything. I got a gold single from it. It was another experience. You know that I'm writing this book.
No.
It's called Let's Dance. Yeah, I've been working on it for half a year or more, you know. And I'm going to call it Let's Dance. I'm going to just tell all those things that happened, especially the Mexican-American and the younger generation, to know that there's more to life than just being famous or, you know. Life is wonderful, and if you enjoy it, you know. And some of us have to fall before we realize how much we got going, and luckily we can get up, some of us.
Any idea on the publishing date for the book?
I'm going to try to finish it this year as soon as I can. I talked to this one guy called Johnny Whiteside. He wrote a book called Cry, his whole life story of Johnny Raven. I used to hear when I was a little guy. He had a big hit called When Your Sweetheart Is a Letter of Goodbye.
Oh, wow. Okay,
that was
yeah.
The name of the song. He wants to do it with me, so I'm going to get some real heavy professionalism because I read his book and it's wonderful.
If you can have Oscar or whoever it is, send me a copy. I would love to get another interview with you, except we'll make it an author interview.
All right. That'd be wonderful because, you know, that's funny. I think that's where I really like to end up. I would like to do book tours and talk, but I would take a couple guys and sing a few songs, you know, and then sign the book. But give them what life's about, you know, where I've been.
Yeah, well, you can by now. You can. Yeah, and people will listen, I think. This edition of KVC Arts has been devoted entirely to Chris Montez, the nicest guy in rock. He's still touring today. More at chrismontez.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Chris Montez, and thanks to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions for originally getting me in touch with him. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jesse Rosales, Sharina Wad, Isel Quapio, Benjamin Perper, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.